Well, welcome to the Michelle Meow Show. You're A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. It's Thursday, so we're here at the Commonwealth Club with my co-host, John Zipper. On Thursdays here at the Commonwealth Club, we do a taping of the show, and then it gets posted up online and distributed to our partners, such as Progressive Voices Network, and then John posts it up as a podcast on the Commonwealth Club page. Today we have a special guest. We're very excited to speak with our guest today. A very inspirational story, a very positive one. She's a software engineer for Ford Motor Company in the Innovations Lab. Let's welcome Lynn Kaiser to the program. Lynn, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Michelle. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah, well, you know, San Francisco is transformed into something else this week, but here at the Commonwealth Club, we'll just go ahead and proclaim today to be Lynn Kaiser Day.
Thanks.
Because for the full hour, we're just going to talk about Lynn. We're going to get to know Lynn and your story. Before we talk about the great, you know, positive impact that you've had at your workplace, let's get to know you and kind of go through childhood. Where'd you grow up and what was that all like?
Well, I'm originally from Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, the home of Joe Namath, a big football country there. I had a nephew play in the NFL for a while. And I was brought up, born in the 50s, raised in the 60s there. Kind of a working class steel mill kind of family. My grandfather retired from the steel mill. My father retired from the steel mill. I worked there summers during college. And it's kind of a suburban neighborhood, nothing too special. I'm the oldest of six. I guess thinking back, you know, you can think back to a lot of different things and put attached stories that may or may not be true. But thinking back to when I was little, 5, 6 years old, I remember playing with my sister's toys and even trying on her clothes and things like that. But I kind of inherently knew, without being told or getting caught, that that wouldn't go well if I had gotten caught. So I kind of put that aside. And my father noticed me playing jump rope with the neighbor girls and playing with my sister's toys. And he said, "Here's a baseball glove. Let's go play baseball." So I joined Little League. And luckily, I liked baseball. So that wasn't a total loss. A lot of women do, actually. So that was kind of nice. And then it was a standard middle class kind of upbringing after that. I knew I was different. I guess I'd put it that way. It was just a vague feeling of being different. And it wasn't into my teens that I didn't really want to date women. But I was kind of nerdy and bookish. So people didn't make too much of that. But into college, I still wasn't dating women. Finally did in my 20s a little bit because it seemed like the thing to do. And I concluded, no, I'm barking up the wrong tree here. Maybe I'm gay. So finally, and just kind of left it for a while, into my 30s, I dated a guy, and 23 years later, we're still together.
Wow. I want to go back to that, because the 23 years later, and that has a lot to do with where you're at today and now and what you're doing.
Yeah.
But John?
Well, describing your father in the baseball glove kind of leads to, so when you started dating men, what was your family's reaction? Was your family conservative, or that was just kind of a role model sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, as the oldest of six, I was kind of the role model for the younger siblings.
Yeah.
My mother, when I told her that I was dating a guy, she said, "Oh, I knew."
Really?
She figured it out, I guess, implied it. Mm-hmm. But my father, he said, "No, you can't be gay." It wasn't. And I said, "Well, yeah, can be." I brought Ken, my husband-to-be, to the house to meet them, and he's really friendly and nice, and so they liked him, so it was okay.
Mm-hmm. Then it'll be interesting to hear what your family or your parents felt, you know, when you came out, I guess, again, as a woman.
Yeah, well, my father had passed by that time, because I sat on it for a long time, for many years. You know, it's one thing coming out as gay or even admitting to yourself you're gay, but coming out even to yourself as transgender, it's a game changer, even from living as a gay man. We were living as a gay couple for many years. And the feelings gradually arose that something wasn't quite right. I didn't quite fit as a gay man. I saw how gay men around me behaved and thought of themselves and interacted with each other, and something didn't quite fit. And so one day, I think I've told you this story, I was watching a movie on TV, and there was a pretty actress in the movie, and it was a Saturday afternoon. They always have the cheesiest science fiction on Saturday afternoon. But I caught myself thinking, wow, I wish I looked like her. And I sat up and thought, oh, wow, what does that mean? And then I started exploring that side of myself. I bought some women's bracelets and was wearing them at home. And my husband saw that and kind of looking funny at me. And I said, I'm just letting out my feminine side a little bit. And he said, is that all? And yeah, that's it. That's it. No more. And that wasn't it. So over the next few years, I'd say this was probably 10 years ago, I just needed to explore that side of myself more. Mm-hmm. Clothing and bracelets and a little bit of makeup. And I remember the first time I'd gone to the thrift store and bought women's clothes and got fully dressed at home when he was away and stood in front of a full-length mirror and started crying because I knew that was me. Mm.
The conversation, the first conversation in, after feeling this and knowing mm-hmm. this with your now husband, mm-hmm. maybe for him it was kind of similar to what it was like for your mom. In, yeah. You know, I knew.
Yeah. Well, my mom, and you're right, I did come out twice. Mm-hmm. And when I told my mom that I'm transgender, she said, I thought you were gay. And I said, I thought I was too. And turned out not to be the case, but she's been very accepting. All except one of my siblings has been very accepting. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to reconnect with the one brother that I'm not in contact with now. My sister's working on him, so hopefully that'll happen. But my mom's been great, and she's getting on in years, so you know she can't see very well anyway. Can't really see. She said, oh, you look great with your hair. That's about all that she could see of me right now.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, you know, this journey. And mm-hmm. you brought up your now husband, yeah. whom you met, and he's from Malaysia.
Right.
And, you know, to be together, you almost have to prove that in a lot of ways. And we're feeling it as here in America, and the immigration policy is just kind of swiftly changing and becoming a hot topic politically. But for you, you know, having to have steady work and a profession for both you and your husband, that was very critical to mm-hmm. being able to be together, which then led to forming a safe, I think, environment for you to transition.
Right.
Let's talk about, you know, just the, I was reading the journey on The Advocate, an article that was out in which it goes through this beautifully.
Yeah, the journey was quite circuitous. It's we lived in New Jersey when we met. He was on a work visa, an H-1B visa, mm-hmm. and we were both living and working in New Jersey. He had gone to college there and was working for a few years when we met. This was in the mid-90s. And we got together. We met through an ad, a personal ad in the newspaper. This is just before the internet took root or was large for dating. So we actually met through a personal ad. I answered an ad in there, left a voicemail, and he called me back. And after the first date, that was it. But anyway, his work visa expired after a few years. He had to leave the country, and in those days, there was no recognition of same-sex couples, which we were at that time. And so he had to leave. I even called and wrote to a number of politicians, and Barney Frank called me. I don't know if you remember Barney.
Barney.
He actually called me on the phone one evening, and we chatted for a half hour, and he said, you know, we're working on it, but there's just nothing that can be done right now. So we ran into a Canadian, an immigration lawyer from Canada in New York. We were living near New York at the time, in New Jersey. And he said that it was pretty easy to get into Canada at the time. So we applied for permanent residence up there. Mm-hmm. And in the fall of 98, we moved to Canada, moved to Vancouver first, and lived there for a couple of years, and then Toronto for a number of years because of work, and then back to Vancouver, and then down here just a few years ago. So it was, and then, oh, the best part. We both became Canadian citizens while we were up there, and now I'm a dual U.S. and Canadian, and he's a dual U.S. and Canadian citizen very recently.
Yeah. I thought the best part was, I mean, just finding yourself coming back here after mm-hmm. we won federal marriage equality. And yeah. that was kind of finally a legal pathway for many of us in the LGBTQ community. And then for yourself, full evolution in terms of happiness. You're, you know, the, in my opinion, that's what I'm going to call it, the evolution of your happiness is...
It is.
Winning that for our community, for yourself, and then setting out on a journey to be your authentic self. And, you know, as a trans woman here in America, it's still very difficult. It's difficult to get a job, still difficult, you know, to, I mean, even the bathroom conversation, I'm embarrassed to even bring that up. Mm-hmm. But you talk openly about creating that path for yourself, and that led you to Ford. Which, and you did a lot of homework. And when somebody brings up, you know, Ford, you know, at any car company in America, you straight up go back into, it's a man's world. It's a
stodgy old-fashioned boys club. Yeah, I had all those notions until I started reading about it. And there's an organization, the Human Rights Commission, HRC, and they have a rating for LGBT friendliness or accommodation or assistance that companies give to their LGBT employees, contractors, vendors, and so forth. And when I got to the Bay Area, I had for some time, while in Canada, been planning to transition at some point, but because we're pursuing immigration back down to the U.S., I kind of held off and didn't want to rock the boat. But in this whole time, or that whole time, I was looking at, once we got settled back in the U.S., how to transition, when, how, you know, for whom would I be working. Mm-hmm. And when I first came down here, it was 2013, because it was just that year that the U.S. Supreme Court changed the rules so that they would recognize same-sex couples for immigration, finally, after all those years. But so we filled out the paperwork and submitted it on behalf of Ken. And our immigration lawyer, who's based out of the Bay Area, said that I should come down here and work and demonstrate that I can provide a home and have an income to support my husband when he finally got down here. So I did that. And it was a little over a year later when his green card came through and he came down here. But in the meantime, I worked for a small startup in Silicon Valley. And once we knew that my husband would be coming down, as he'd actually gotten approved to come down here, I approached the subject of transitioning with the owners of the small company. This being California, they knew they would have had to accommodate me, mm-hmm. but the look, there was a look of consternation, I guess you'd call it, that came over their faces, especially one of the two owners. So I said, I'll keep you posted. And right then I started looking around for another company. Well, in the meantime, I'd become interested in self-driving cars. That's all the rage in Silicon Valley these days. And so I started looking for jobs related to that and saw the posting with Ford. And at Ford, and they looked them up. They were rated 100%, 100 on the HRC ratings, right up there with Google and Apple and Facebook and everyone else. Started reading more about them, and it looked like a very progressive company. On the part of LGBT employees and whoever else they deal with, and thought, that's kind of interesting. It's up, right up my alley. So I applied and got the job. That was in 2015, September of 2015, a little over 3 years.
Yeah. And so you got into Ford. You knew you wanted to transition. Mm-hmm. When did you then start approaching that subject with your employers there?
Well, the first thing I did is I got in touch with the LGBT resource group, mm-hmm. Ford Globe, and contacted someone, the leader of it, Bill, whom you know well, in Michigan, because that's where the majority of Ford employees are, and discussed my thoughts of transitioning, and he said, yeah, it's quite doable. We've helped people to go through it. There's someone here that has actually helped someone with the paperwork here, mm-hmm. and they're doing quite well. So that was very encouraging. So I had been with the company 5 months, maybe something like that, and talked to first the HR manager in our office. It's a small office in Palo Alto where I work. And he said, you know, I haven't done this before, but I'll be glad to help you. I'll learn. and work with you. Then I talked to my direct supervisor, and he said, oh, yeah, I've done this before. So you know, he'd actually worked with someone in Michigan who had transitioned, and I hadn't known that. And so they told me what to do, what paperwork I needed to do, and then we decided on a date, and this was January of 2016 when I finally decided on a date. I chose Leap Day 2016, February 29th, as a leap into the future, I guess, poetic. And at an all-hands in January, every month we have an all-hands in a large kitchen just to talk about what's going on in the office. And with my permission, my supervisor announced to everyone there that I would be transitioning at the end of February and be known as Lynn. And people clapped. I wasn't sure. I was scared to death. But people clapped, came up and hugged me, and said they have my back. And it was just amazing. It's the way that I would have written a heartwarming story, I guess. And it was real. It actually happened that way.
I would think that would be the dream of how anyone going through this would hope it would happen.
Yeah.
Did any of your colleagues besides your supervisor know about this beforehand?
Yeah, I had talked to a few of them, the people I was kind of close to and that I trusted with the information. And they were a little bit surprised. I looked like a stodgy middle-aged engineer, male engineer. They were a little bit surprised, but they were all very supportive, and they could, because the people that I sat next to, they could see me. Sometimes I'd start trembling at my desk, literally, and I'd have to go out to the car and have a cry, and I finally had to tell them what was going on. And one of them said, "You got to do something." So at their prompting, I also decided to transition.
Wow, I have so many more questions, especially about Ford, but it's very uplifting, and I'm ecstatic to hear how positive of an experience you had. By the way, I'm just going to do a quick reset for those tuning in. You're listening to the Michelle Meow Show. We've got a great group today at the Commonwealth Club. Lunch has been provided by Ceremony Ford, so thank you, Ceremony Ford, and the Castro Car Guy. We're speaking with Lynn Kaiser, who's talking about transitioning on the job at a company like Ford Motor Company. So my question is, are you the first to transition?
I'm not. Mm-hmm. In fact, I found out from the people at the Globe LGBT Resource Group that there's at least three others in Michigan, that I was introduced to one. I met one when I was back there on a trip, one person, and heard about a couple more. So definitely not the first. And those are only the trans women that I happen to meet. And I don't know how many trans men there are in the company at this point. I never happened to meet any. Mm-hmm. But I know of at least several others. And I'm not the last. I've been approached since then, especially the article in The Advocate in late 2016, from other people within Ford in different parts of the country and world. And three of them have gone on to transition successfully as trans women.
There's a woman that is also an inspiration to me, and we've done an interview with her before. Her name is Vivian Ming. I'm not sure if you know Vivian.
I know of her,
and
I think my friend Grace knows her.
Yeah, so personally. Vivian is amazing, but she's also a tech leader, transgender activist, a mom, wife, and she speaks very openly about her personal journey. But there was something she said that stuck with me. You know, there's this big talk about diversity in tech and for these large corporations and how to address that. And one thing she talked about was that she was very much supportive and believed in diversity in tech because there's something about tech that is based on meritocracy in terms of what, you know, you can do, you can perform versus the identity and how that could change hiring practices. Mm-hmm. How do you feel? I mean, you know, being a part of a huge, large company like Ford, that's not necessarily, you know, it's got a lot of tradition, it's got a lot of history, a lot of years, and it's not some of the, you know, like a startup.
Well, it's a little bit different at our lab in Palo Alto. It is essentially a tech hub. It is one of the tech hubs for Ford. Mm-hmm. And it does have that meritocracy kind of mindset. And I've seen that within the technical industry in Silicon Valley. It is very much a meritocracy. And it is kind of a respite for LGBT people in general because nobody really cares who you are or what you are. It's just what you can do and how you interact with other people. Mm-hmm. And so I think that definitely attracts LGBT people in general and trans people in particular.
So your first day when you went to work as Lynn, what was that like?
Oh, I was terrified. You know, people were nice ahead of time, and they knew. Mm-hmm. When I first went in, I decided just to own it, walked right in, and walked around and reintroduced myself to people.
Yeah.
And I'd got the look, as I call it, the look of kind of a befuddled smile. Lynn, is it now, did you say? And yeah. And it kind of put me off at first. And in fact, I got that in a lot of places I went in the professional circles mm-hmm. that I work in. The look, as I call it, where they just don't quite know how to react to you. And, I felt a little bad at first, but then I learned how to defuse that just by going up and joking with people and talking about projects and everything else, just any topic under the sun, like anyone else does. What I did over the weekend, asked what they did. And you have to remember when you're transitioning that you may be the center of attention, but people have their own lives, their own problems. So I learned to ask about that, yeah. like colleagues generally do. I had to remember, I had to force myself to remember that they have a life and difficulties themselves. And once you start talking to people in their own terms, the look just goes away, and then you're just two people talking. So and it's gotten kind of satisfying since then. I've learned how to do it very quickly. And it's fun to watch yeah. that look melt away, and then we're just two yeah. people talking.
What about awkward moments? Maybe not moments of discrimination, but mm-hmm. maybe awkward moments in which you have to help educate and inform others about you and transgender issues.
Well, in the Bay Area, I don't have to educate people too much mm-hmm. because a lot of people have seen trans people, and it's just. It's a very liberal and tolerant and accepting area. It's on the phone. I get sir a lot, and I've tried the voice lessons, and it's really hard to change your voice, and there's surgery available, and I'm scared of that. So I get sir on the phone a lot, and I remind people and just say I'm a trans woman, and I'm working on the voice, and it's and they say, oh, I'm sorry, and then 2 seconds later, it's sir again. So that's kind of a... I don't know, it's awkward. It's really awkward in how many times do I correct them before I just kind of let it go.
Mm-hmm.
In person, not so much. People see the way I appear and my name and kind of put two and two together around here. And even in other parts of the country I've been, people pick up on it. I'm visibly trans. They can figure that out, but they can tell that I'm a trans woman from my dress and behavior and name.
There's a story, I know I've talked about it on your show before, Michelle. And it's a story, I don't know if it's true, but I've heard it. And this was George W. Bush. It might have been while he was still president or after. But he went back to his former college for some reunion or something. And this woman walks up to him and, hi, I'm so-and-so. And she said, in college, you knew me as, going to make up a name, John Smith, And he said, last time you saw me, that was John Smith. And he said, well, now you're here as yourself. And I thought, that struck me, and I hope it's a true story, because that to me was him saying, this is you,
mm-hmm.
completely accepted. Now, whether or not you think that followed through in policies and such of his administration is one thing, but once you were able to be Lynn, did your stress level go down? I mean, did you, what emotional and psychological
well,
changes did you
Well, very early on, the stress level went up because I was afraid of people's sure. reactions, whether I would be accepted or whether people would just be walking on eggshells when they're around me and just I would be kind of isolated. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of stress there, but very quickly at work, people got used to my new self, the way I appeared and my new name. It took a little while to remember the name in some cases for the people who had known me prior. But very quickly, within a couple of weeks, I'd say I wasn't getting a look at work mm-hmm. because people knew me as Lynn by then, and we'd talked about projects and things going on in the company and just had to get past all that very quickly. So they were, I got some congratulations early on, and even now, once in a while, I'll get the common theme of, you're very brave to do this. And the way I put it is, I guess, there's a certain fear to overcome, but it's not so much bravery as just being a necessity to have a good life.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're being chased. I read one really interesting analogy. You're being chased by wolves, and to run in and close the door in your cabin, well, is that brave or is that just self-preservation? And to me, this was self-preservation.
Yeah.
Let's talk about transgender issues and unemployment. I brought it up earlier. Yeah. It's not easy for transgender folks to be employed for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
Your story is a positive story, an inspirational one, and one that, you know, again, this journey that you're on is very, very specific to Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
So for those out there, and when you're speaking to the community, you know, what are some things that you will say to the community who, you know, we seem to get down on ourselves sometimes to say that it's really hard to get back up or to get out of this hole?
And it kind of depends on the audience. If it's someone who's a working professional, has been working as a professional for a number of years, my story is more applicable to them. So I can relate my own experience and the way I treated it, and maybe they can draw some analogies there and get some encouragement. The unfortunate part is younger LGBT people who maybe were kicked out of their homes, didn't have a chance to even finish high school, let alone go to college, and just didn't have the opportunity that I had to go to college and become an engineer and build a career. That's a tougher one. I guess my first lesson as an elder in the community to younger trans people who have had a lot of hardship because they were discriminated against as kids by their own families in many cases, is first find shelter, find a place to stay, and finish your education, whatever you have to do. So it depends on the audience.
Mm.
Do you feel like a role model? I mean, do you accept that an elder? I mean,
as an elder in the LGBT community, I do. I've kind of been approached by enough people that, I do consider myself a role model at this point, strictly because I'm older and have done a lot more.
Well, I think we were talking before the program about having been able to really create your life in the direction you wanted it to go to, mm-hmm. and how important that can be for other people to see someone doing that. Talk a little bit about that importance. And did you have people you were able to look at when you were thinking of transitioning, when you were recognizing that you were trans and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I went to support groups for a number of years, even while we were still living in Canada prior to coming down here a few years ago. So I did see those role models. Now, in the support groups, you tend to see people who are still in the struggling stage. But there are some there that have transitioned during or gone on to careers after transitioning. So I did have a few of those people as role models.
Your first Pride participation?
Well, the first one that I ever marched, I've marched in like the Dyke March and the Trans March and things like that. But for the first one was a full participant was just this past June here in San Francisco.
Wow. And was that with Ford?
With Ford.
How did that make you feel? I there's this growing conversation about being part of the LGBTQ community and then marching with your company. And, you know, who are you representing, the company or yourself?
Well, both.
Yeah.
It is very much the company because they had treated me very well and made me made it possible for me to – here I am tongue-tied thinking about it. Almost ready to cry, actually, but they made it possible for me to be myself and all aspects of myself, including the professional part of myself. I mean, I joke, but it's only half joking that the deepest core identity that I recognize it is an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the one thing that's been steady in my personality all these many years. It was straight-ish guy, or questioning guy, and then gay guy, and then questioning gay guy, and then trans woman, and I had to face all those different aspects of my identity, but the professional part hasn't changed, and to be able to embrace that and be recognized for that and for my true, hopefully final self as a trans woman by the company, I wanted to recognize that and celebrate that as a thing that they should be proud of.
Thank you for saying that. I think, you know, we don't ask enough about also our participation in the community and how we can make changes, you know, of who we are 9 to 5 and then who we are, I guess, 5 and beyond.
Yeah.
Well, again, I have more questions about the workplace. But John, do you have something to add to that?
Well, you mentioned the engineer, and I've been waiting to ask more just the nerdy question of what is your job? What do you do? What are some of the neat things you get to work on?
Well, I can talk about what's publicly known.
No. Yeah, Just tell us the secret stuff.
No problem. Here you go.
Everyone from Chevy and Tesla is listening in right now.
My colleagues back there will keep me honest.
Well, that's okay if Tesla's listening.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll change
much. Couldn't do anything.
So my new title, I was a software engineer and changed to, I'm called a research engineer. It's more of figuring out what projects to work on, what research projects to work on, and leading those, working with younger people, newer engineers, and on a research project idea to try out new things. I do a lot of interaction with the tech community here in Silicon Valley. It's very big with the connected vehicle and autonomous vehicles. My area of specialty is connected vehicle, where you have 4G, 5G, very high-speed connection between vehicles that communicate with each other to avoid collisions and cooperate in traffic and hopefully slow down some of this horrendous traffic congestion that we saw today, as a matter of fact. So that's kind of one thing that I'm working on. And also just enabling autonomous vehicles with that high-speed connection to the internet, because there's a lot of data that will have to go back and forth. So that's kind of the nerdy answer of what I do. It's proposing and leading projects, working with the local tech community. Part of our mandate in our office is to get out with and work with the startups and the local companies.
But it's got to be exciting to be working on stuff that is at the frontiers of what we're doing. And, you know, you're not coming out with, not to downplay people who are coming out with a new car, but I mean, you're coming out with vehicles that are doing something different, that are, you know, that are forcing legal changes on allow autonomous cars, you know, all that kind of stuff. That in itself has got to be very stimulating.
It's real rewarding. I've been in this engineering game for a long time, and this is, you know, by far the most personally satisfying, professionally satisfying thing I've done, because it matters.
Yeah.
It really matters. If you look at the traffic, when I moved to the Bay Area in 2013, the first thing I noticed was the traffic and thought to myself, somebody has to do something about that. And I am.
I think I've been dreaming about this moment since the Jetsons. I mean,
I want a flying car too. Don't get me wrong.
No, but realistically, I think, you know, 16 when I failed my driving test 3 times, and I just said somebody's got to drive for me. I mean, I got to be at this place, and now here in 2018, it might be possible. What do you think? How soon? I mean, it's already out there, the technology, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Ford and many other companies are testing them on the street. If you go to Mountain View, you'll see the formerly Google, now Waymo vehicles running around, and we have a lot of vehicles ourselves running around in different parts of the country. The public announcement that Ford has made is 2021, and I guess if you want to follow up more, my colleagues here will be glad to talk about any new updates that we may have as far as dates, but that was the last publicly announced date.
Is there a web page at Ford, you know, Ford.com, autonomous or something like that, that people can find out more about?
I suspect there is. Let's find out later.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to open it up to questions on the floor very soon here. And I mean, any interest on the self-driving car, the technology is all selfish between John and I. I need someone to drive.
I love driving, but my mom hates driving. So she will be one of the first ones in line.
But again, I mean, it really is your story, just everything about you and everything you're working on. It's shaping the future in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that your story alone and everything that you're doing gives people a lot of hope. And that hope is that the future would change for transgender people. Mm-hmm. And so my biggest question I've wanted to ask you all afternoon is, you know, being such a visionary, someone that is very innovative and have also found your own way, what that vision might be for the future of the transgender community, who seem to be the most marginalized of many of us in this country.
Well, my dream long term is that it's just another aspect of being human, like you're of a different ethnic background, something akin to that. Everyone has their own personal medical history, and generally it's not much of is made of that. And that's what I would see long-term for the transgender community. We're just We have maybe a little different medical and personal history, but other than that, it's just one more aspect like any other aspect of people's lives, whether it be cultural or health or racial or any other identity or aspect of themselves. It's part of their personal life, and it doesn't really impact what they can do, who they can be in society, and what kind of career they can follow. So that's the long-term dream. Nearer term, I'd say there's a lot of work that can be done within the transgender community and with allies to, get people educated. That's been the biggest shortcoming for people, especially younger people who didn't have that opportunity because they were bullied, they were discriminated against. So I think that's the first step, is to get people educated.
John, do you have a question before we open it up to our audience?
It's forming in my head, so actually, why don't we open up the audience?
That.
I'll break
okay.
in if I can think of it.
So we have a mic that we can pass around. Again, this is being recorded, so if you could to ask your question in the mic, that would be great. Question for Lynn.
Hello, Lynn.
Hi.
I had two questions, mm-hmm. because as an immigrant myself from Pakistan, mm-hmm. How was your feeling for being an American and then immigrating to Canada? That is one question. And secondly, I was quite interested, like, what was the wording of that ad which you put in?
He put it in. I answered his ad. So
okay, so that... And what was that ad? Because even, you know, like, long time ago at mm-hmm. that time, mm-hmm. how were people... Like, if there was an ad like that, how would people react to that kind of ad?
Well, thinking back, this was in New Jersey in 1995, I think, late 94, 95. And I don't know how many people, probably a number of people here, remember the personal ads in the newspapers. It's an obsolete concept now. But it's something like GAM, gay Asian male. There was a code for each variety of human in the personal ads.
It's okay. We know.
Yeah,
we're
know
very
all that.
Familiar
yeah.
with acronyms in the LGBTQ
yeah.
community.
So, yeah. GAM, seeking GWM for dating and relationships. Likes outdoors, travel, this, that, and the other thing. Puppies, rainbows. You know, I can't remember what it said, but it's something like that. And I like the outdoors, so that kind of attracted me. And so I left a voicemail at the number, and he called me back on my home phone, and we talked, and then dated the following weekend, dated again the weekend after that, and forevermore, and within about 6 months, we had moved in. Immigrating to Canada. It's not that big a cultural difference between the U.S. and Canada, so I wasn't terribly worried about it. It was more about the career. There aren't as many jobs in general in Canada, so that was a tougher nut. And I knew that ahead of time, that it would be more difficult to continue my career there. It just took longer to reestablish. But other than that, Canadians are really friendly. It's a great country in general for LGBT people, especially in the cities. So we settled first in Vancouver, very open and tolerant city, and then lived in Toronto for a number of years and back to Vancouver before we came here. So as an immigrant into Canada, for both of us, it was fairly straightforward. It wasn't very stressful. We were welcomed as LGBT people, and my husband to be as an Asian man. There's a lot of Asian people in the Canadian cities, so he felt right at home as well. So it was easy.
And this is your closest relationship, so I'm not trying to ask anything confidential, mm-hmm. Too personal, but... We kind of got around this a little bit, but when you made the decision to transition and when you were realizing this is what I am, how did that work with Kent? I mean, was he afraid that he might lose you, or was this just he's willing to go along with whatever the journey is?
No, it was gradual. Mm-hmm. You know, he saw the bracelets and kind of wondered what's going on. And I told him it was my feminine side coming out. And he said, "You're not going to like go all the way, are you?" And I said, "No, no, no." But it progressed from there, and he saw that. And then finally, he had traveled. He had gone on a trip and came back. And I said, I have something to tell you when he got home. I'm having gender identity issues. And we were up basically all night talking from that and trying to, and he's saying, I don't know if I can stay with you or I'll stay with you until you transition. And we had a lot of conversations in the first year of that type, whether he could stay with me, whether we should stay together, whether it was fair to each other. If he's a gay man, I mean, he just doesn't, not romantically interested in women. So it took a year or two to kind of get to the point where, yes, we do really love each other and want to stay together, and we'll have a different life, but still have a good life as family.
Thank you for sharing. Mm-hmm. So it seems like you and Ken are soulmates, and I'm a big hopeless romantic.
Yeah,
so I kind of want to hear more about your first date and how you guys knew from then on that, hey, this is the one.
Well, I can tell you some things about our first date.
it's all because you don't remember.
That's
it was
right.
Such a long time ago.
it's just slipped my mind. But he returned my call. And we agreed to meet, and I went over to his apartment in New Jersey, and then we went to a pub in a nearby town in New Jersey, and wasn't very fancy. The salad, we joke about this to this day, our very first date, the salad that they served, they chopped a head of lettuce in half. We each got a half of the head of lettuce, and they poured dressing on it. And that was that's pretty much what I remember about that, and we walked around town a bit, and that was really the most memorable aspect of the first date, was that salad.
So. Hyland, you mentioned seeing yourself as a role model,
mm-hmm.
and it's because you've become an elder in the community. Was there a pivotal moment or a connection with someone else where maybe the light bulb went off, or any milestone in your journey?
I think when I realized that I was seen as a role model was when the first person within Ford, as a matter of fact, contacted me and said, I'm considering this myself and I've been really nervous, and what can you tell me about your experience? And that's when it really clicked that being out in public like that, I would get questions and people would want my help. So that's when it clicked that I was, whether I wanted to or not, and it turns out I don't mind. It's an honor. But that was really when I considered myself a role model.
It's one thing to be a role model within a circle, a kind of an enclosed circle, if you will, even a large one like Ford.
Mm-hmm.
But when the Advocate article was coming out, in other words, where people who didn't know you, didn't know your company, well, mm-hmm. everyone's heard of Ford, but, weren't part of that, that they might start recognizing you. Were you sure you were ready for that?
I guess I was a little nervous about dealing with people that I had never known before. Mm-hmm. But once I saw that they were sincere and they were in pain, then I knew that I just had to talk to them. I hadn't got approached by anyone who wasn't sincere, let's put it that way.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Hyland.
Hi.
So talking about both being a role model and that education is a way for progress to the future, can you talk about working as a living book and where you do that and what that entails?
Oh, yeah, that's something else. I have been volunteering at the San Mateo County Pride Center, and a person there put me in touch with the Human Library, which is kind of a cool concept, and it fits in with my thinking. The idea is that people act as human books. And you go to an event, maybe a library. In fact, this past Saturday, it was at the Redwood City Library. And these human books, of which I'm one, each one has their own story. I'm the transgender person. There was a Muslim, a police officer, a veteran, a disabled person, and so on, a number of people. And the members of the public could come in and check us out for 20 minutes and just start asking questions, and anything goes. Whereas if you see someone who's different on the street, you're probably not going to just walk up to them and start asking questions about themselves. But this was an opportunity for people to do that. The idea being that if you actually meet someone and talk to them and learn about who they are as a person, you're not going to be afraid of them anymore. And that's the way I've always felt.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my question. When you coined the phrase when you got the look, like mm-hmm. when you came back to work the first day after transitioning. Is there any talk among the transgender community about just people's curiosity? Because when people give you the look, they may not be intending a bad look. It's like, wow, that's different, mm-hmm. or, you know. So then it kind of becomes your job to educate everybody. And that, I'm sure, can be a little bit tiring, because some days you just wake up exhausted and you just want to be Lynn. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't want to deal with the look. Mm-hmm. So can you elaborate on that a little bit, like about the look? Like, have there been times when you got the look and maybe didn't respond in a positive way because you were sick and tired of the look?
Mm. I would say I never reacted in a negative way. I always try to be polite with people and just engage them one person to another. But it does get tiring after a while. Now, at work, everyone knows me. They have known me for a long time. Even new people quickly learn who I am when we just talk. So I don't get that at work. But I go to a lot of conferences, and sometimes I see the same people, and, oh, there's one advantage to being visibly trans, too. People remember me. I'll go to a lot of conferences, and people say, hi, Lynn, and I'm thinking, hi, you. So there's actually some advantage to it professionally, but I still get the look when I'm with a group maybe I haven't been with very much at a conference. There are people coming in from out of the country, and it does get a little tiring, especially if I've been really busy and I'm already tired. And it's a certain level of work. You're right. It's work on my part to have to engage them and put them at ease. I've learned to do it fairly efficiently, so I guess it's not that as much work as it used to be. I'll put it that way.
Any others? Oh, back there.
Hi, this is not really a question. I just want to say I'm one of the recipients of her role model service. When I read the article in The Advocate, I tracked Lynn down. I emailed her, and we actually went for a coffee. I'd been about a year trying to figure out how I could transition as like a software executive. About 30 minutes I spent for lunch or coffee, whatever, with her, and I think within 2 weeks after I came out on Facebook and through all my investors and all my companies, and seeing her story made it me realize that I could actually do it and succeed in life. So thank you.
My pleasure. I'm really glad to be your friend. A bad influence, aren't I?
Well, Lynn, your story is very inspiring, and thank you so much for all this information. I just had one more question.
Sure.
I think it is important. Mm-hmm. You have lived in Canada, and you said the people over there are really friendly and open to LGBT.
They are, at least in the city areas, certainly.
Yeah. So, like, what is in that culture the element which is present over there and it's not here in America, and how can we bring that here also?
I think in Canada it's different for a couple of reasons. For one, the cultural makeup of Canada is somewhat different. Their history is somewhat different. Canadians are known by and large as polite people, and they really are. People are really nice to you on the street. Your neighbors will help you and so forth. In the U.S., it may be a little more competitive. Job-wise or commercial, you know, any kind of competition you can think of. Americans in general, a little more competitive, and that reflects in a little less tolerance of other people, I think. And I think it's historical and cultural, the difference between the two countries. And for some reason, Canadians ended up being known rightfully as very polite, nice people.
It's funny how many folks I'll read about from Europe who will talk about how nice Americans are. So if they ever went to Canada, their minds would be blown.
Yes. Now, to be fair, there are plenty of nice people in the U.S., and I've met tons of them in recent years. And I've been really lucky. I don't put myself in places where I think that people are going to be nasty to me or in harm's way. But then again, as a woman, I have to be aware of my surroundings like every other woman in history has ever had to do. So I'm careful where I go and who I associate with. So I tend to just surround myself with nice people. So that's why I see most people as being nice. You can find the people who aren't so nice if you look for them. I think in general, just Americans are more competitive. So maybe a little less supportive in some ways. But that's not true everywhere or for everyone. There's lots of nice people here, too.
All right. Well, that's perfect timing because we're winding down. And John, if you have a question, I'll let you ask one before I ask the last question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. Not going to learn any secrets about Ford's technology that's under development.
Not unless we hire you, dear.
I'll give you my resume later.
Okay.
How often you're in the Pride March? How often are you doing public talks and putting yourself out there for folks?
Probably several times a month.
That's quite a bit.
This was the third thing in a week that I've done.
Wow.
The Human Library, you asked, was this past Saturday. And then on Monday, I appeared in front of the Mental Health Services Advisory Board for San Mateo County on behalf of the Pride Center there. And then here today, and I don't think there's anything scheduled for next week, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's something shortly after that. And I realize I have to slow down at some point, but it's an honor, and it's something I think needs to be done.
Were you always willing to be that public, even before you transitioned?
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. I'm 10 times as talkative as I used to. I think part of it is psychological. I can be myself, don't have to hide anything. That's a lot of work. Hiding part of that important part of yourself is a lot of work.
Yeah.
And I think just being... having that freedom as a woman, mm-hmm. women just are expected to share more emotional things. So I didn't feel that living in boy mode, and I just feel that freedom now.
That's a great segue to my last question. And you know, your unique experiences make the incredible person that you are, and the courage that you have. We talked about, you know, the transgender community and employment opportunities. I think that there's still more work to be done. I think there should be more trans executives. There should be more trans software engineers. Mm-hmm. There should be more trans elected leaders even.
Yeah.
What is that work? You know, what do you think? And I think part of it is people like you who will talk about your story mm-hmm. and be an inspiration. But specifically in the workplace, and how do we get companies that we work for, how do we make them even bigger allies?
Well, as a matter of fact, maybe afterward we can talk to Grace, who's doing a lot of that kind of work herself.
Mm-hmm.
The part of it is to get people trained, make them aware, make transgender people aware that you can get into technology if you want to. That's the big, you know, the most open avenue of chasing a career in the Bay Area. But getting into to companies, I guess, as a member of the Ford Globe LGBT Resource Group, we do network with companies locally, and some of them are not as active, I guess, in promoting opportunities for transgender people as Ford and some other larger companies in the Bay Area have been. So we try to make them aware of that there's a demographic out there that is quite talented and underutilized. So I guess it's the connections.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. Thank you all for being here with us at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you again to Ceremony Ford and Castro Car Guy for providing lunch today. And of course, a big, huge thank you to our amazing guest, Lynn Kaiser. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Michelle.
You can hear this program on Progressive Voices Network today or this afternoon at 4 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. We'll also post it up as a podcast on the Commonwealth Club website. For everything else, you can head to michellemeow.com. We hope to see you again.
Okay.